My name is Paul Holdengraber, and I'm the director of Live from the New York Public Library. Though a summer has gone by and a new motto should have been found for what Live from the New York Public Library stands for, I will still persist and say one more time that my goal here at the library is to make the lions roar, to make a heavy institution dance, to make it, as it were, levitate. It is a pleasure to welcome all of you to our four Live from the New York Public Library season and to our opening night with Associate Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer and also legal scholar and professor Jeffrey Rosen. Later this season, I invite you to come hear conversations between Angela Davis and Toni Morrison, David Grossman and Nicole Krauss, Antonio Damasio and Marina Abramovitz, Ruth Reichel, René Redzepi and David Chang, an evening celebrating the National Lampoon, and the Robert Silvers lecture given this year by Derek Walcott, as well as evenings with Lady Antonia Fraser, Keith Richards, Zadie Smith, and Jay-Z. Keith Richards has written in his upcoming autobiography that when he was a child, there were two institutions that mattered to him: the church, which belongs to God, and the library, which belongs to the people. He has said that the library is a great equalizer. I would like to encourage all of you to become friends of the New York Public Library. You will get discounts on all Live tickets and much more. I would like also to warmly thank tonight's sponsor, Sutherland, Aspill & Brennan, a proud supporter of the New York Public Library and a member of its library, Lawyers for the Library Committed. Founded in 1924, Sutherland provides legal services throughout the United States and worldwide to diverse clients in seven major practice areas: corporate, energy and environmental, financial services, intellectual property, litigation, real estate, and tax. Many, many thanks to Sutherland for their continued support and trust. As always, I would also like to thank our independent bookseller, 192 Books. Supreme Court Justice Judge Breyer has agreed to sign his new book, Making Our Democracy Work, after our conversation. Our conversation will last about as long as a psychoanalytical session when your shrink is generous. Stephen Breyer is an Associate Justice of the United States Supreme Court. He was appointed to the Supreme Court by President Bill Clinton in 1994 and confirmed by the U.S. Senate in an 87-9 vote. He took his seat on the Supreme Court on August 3, 1994. In 2005, he published Active Liberty. Making Our Democracy Work, A Judge's View has been published, is just out. It is a pleasure to welcome Justice Breyer to the New York Public Library. Jeffrey Rosen, welcome. Jeffrey Rosen is also of The Unwanted Gaze, The Destruction of Privacy in America, which came out in 2000. He recently published a Supreme Court, The Personalities and Rivalries That Defined America, in 2007. Jeff Rosen is a professor of law at George Washington University and the legal affairs editor of The New Republic. You will also often and to great effect hear him on National Public Radio. The Los Angeles Times has called him the nation's most widely read and influential legal commentator. In 2003, his wedding was officiated by Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg of the Supreme Court and officiated at the Arts Club of Washington. I would like to acknowledge and warmly welcome Jeff's parents here tonight, as well as members of Stephen Breyer's family. Please welcome to this stage tonight at the New York Public Library, Jeffrey Rosen and Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer.
Am I supposed to go here? Here? Yeah. Okay.
You're in the middle, between right. Us two.
Okay.
I have to explain a little bit why I am here. I know practically nothing about the law, very little about it. I did study law, but in a very... You don't hear me?
No.
right now.
Can you hear me? I have a louder voice.
Maybe you should say something. Do you hear me now?
No.
See if that works.
Can you do that again?
Now try.
I must fix. Does this work?
No.
No. Isn't it wonderful? How about now? How about now? Yeah? I must explain now to you why I'm here tonight. I know very little about the law. I did study law a long time ago, but I'm here really because this is not working, is it? Jeffrey, you say something.
On behalf of Paul, I'm so glad to welcome you here tonight. And Paul is here because he runs the Spectacular Program, which is an adornment to the cultural and civic life of our country. And Justice Breyer has honored all of us by joining us for the opening of this great library. Paul, why am I riffing the opening of the library session?
Well, no, it's very... Now you hear me or
yes.
Still not?
Well, Paul also wants to tell you.
Please.
Why don't I take this off?
That he recently met Justice.
Does this work? This work? Oh, go. Okay. Go ahead. No. You go ahead. No. No, I'm going to speak for you.
After you, my friend.
No, please. I was going to say it sounds like a routine, a comedy routine we're doing. I'll give you back your mic in a moment.
You can use mine.
Exactly, but. It strikes me that I've never done this before. I have never interviewed or had a conversation with someone where there have been two interlocutors. I am particularly pleased to be welcoming Justice Breyer, and I want to explain very quickly that about 4 years ago, I met Justice Breyer in Sun Valley at the Writers' Conference, and I had no idea that in meeting a justice... from the Supreme Court, I would be meeting a man whose interests were not only legal in nature, but who had deep interests in literature. And I am particularly interested and in speaking with him about that in a certain context. Here to assist me, and really for the meat of the evening, as it were, we have Jeff Breyer. Jeff will address the more important, one might say, appearance of this new book and will in some way talk to us about why this book matters now. I would like to ask, though, the justice to start out, and I'll give you back your mic if you could put it back on. I will ask the justice now why he wrote this book at this particular moment and why this notion, what this notion of workable democracy means.
Well, first, let me thank you for inviting me to the library, and I apologize for being late, but they were showing me these terribly interesting things, Walt Whitman's manuscripts, Dickens' chair. I tried sitting down in that. I thought it might do me some good. And my son, Michael, is now a library commissioner in San Francisco. So I'm going to say you can improve the library quite a lot if you just get the collection from here and move it out there. That isn't a bad idea. Now, thank you. So, question. Why did I write this? There are a number of reasons. Some are quite personal. In part, it reflects an effort of my looking back after 16 years on the court and wondering to myself whether the cases fit together in a kind of approach or whether it's sort of decide this here, decide this there. I think it was the first, which I was hoping for. But the more general reason is this. When I was appointed, Harry Blackman, my predecessor, told me two things. First, he said in a slightly facetious way, you're going to find this an unusual assignment. That was true. But second, he said he's learned that the American public has an unquenchable thirst to find out what this institution is, the Supreme Court. And he said, when you have a chance, tell people what you do. And I've taken that to heart. And I can't speak to everyone. And a certain number, though, more than I can speak to, might read this book. And if they do, then they'll see my effort to say what this institution is from my perspective. And after all, I only know it from my perspective. Really, I think maybe people before have said this, but what we know best is our own thought processes. And the reason, if I write from my perspective, that others may learn something is they'll see at least how one justice looks at it. And I've tried to be as general as possible in a way as non-controversial as possible. I want to explain what the institution is about, and I'm doing so for a reason. I believe it's important to people to support it in this country, to have the idea of an institution like ours. Now, Hamilton had a problem. When Hamilton wanted to have a constitution that would be enforced, he writes in Federalist 56, we should have someone who can enforce it, even against a law of Congress. Because if we don't, it will be like more like the Met than like the library. This document will be a nice document to hang on a wall, to look at, perhaps as a work of art, but it won't be effective. Then he says, who should have the power to enforce it? The president? If the president does, then he will become a tyrant. He already has enough power. Well, what about Congress? They're elected. But there, he said, lies the problem, because they know how to be popular. There is no one who knows better. But in fact, if this is to be enforced, many times it will have to be enforced in favor of people who are intensely unpopular. And do you believe that Congress often, having passed a law that is popular, will then turn around and say, it's unconstitutional? Yes, exactly. That's what he thought. And so he said, we do have one other group of people, sort of obscure bureaucrats, judges. No one's heard of them. They're not very powerful. They don't have the power of the purse. They don't have the power of the sword. And they'll probably try to do their job. They won't be too aggressive. And so they're the ones we have to give the power to. Now, the question he never asked was this. If these judges have neither purse nor sword, and few have heard of them, and the decisions they make will sometimes be very unpopular, why will anyone do what they say? Good question. That's Hotspur's question. You know that probably in Henry IV, Owen Glendower, who's Welsh and therefore a mystic, says, I can summon spirits from the vasty deep, and Hotspur replies, well, so can I, so can any man, but will they come when you do call for them? All right, now, I want to write a little bit about history so that people understand the fragility of this institution. I want to tell them stories about when presidents didn't follow this decision of a court. And I want to tell them other cases, as when President Eisenhower sent paratroopers to enforce desegregation in Arkansas. Some of us remember that. And I want to show people overall that it's a strong institution, but still fragile. Neither as fragile as it used to be, nor so strong that we can count on it forever. And of course, I'm helping to build support by showing what we have to do. And I want to explain to people, too, how it looks when I do it. And there, to be very honest with you, I think if I ask in this room, what is it that leads to these decisions? You'll say politics. Many of you will. And many people will, because what they read is what they see in the press. And the press is interested in decisions that are very controversial from a political or social point of view. But that's not what the job looks like inside. So I'm trying to explain why I think that word is not a very good description of what we do. I can't say zero, but I'd say if that's the word you use, it's a gross exaggeration. So I want to show what that's like. And overall, I want people to try to learn the history of the court in part. What is this about? Last word. It's an effort to do what Sandra O'Connor does every day, and so does David Souter. To say, please, can we not return to a world where there is such a thing as 12th grade civics taught in the classrooms of the United States?
Now, Justice Breyer, 12th grade civics doesn't do justice to this book, because one of its many pleasures is that it is written for the citizens as adults. You deal with complicated subjects and technical cases. You summarize them clearly for non-lawyers without simplifying them. And you make a nuanced, complicated argument that's fresh and surprising. And I want to ask you about different aspects of it. So you're trying to answer Hotspur's question. And you're trying to say, how can the court ensure that its unpopular decisions are accepted by the public? How does it increase its legitimacy? And you give a bunch of reasons. The first way that you say that the court can do this is choose a method of interpretation that the American public can accept. And you say that's an approach called a living constitution. You say most people support that approach and that they don't favor an approach based on the original understanding of the Constitution. I'm pleased to report, Justice, I did just a little research on this question to try to impress you with my diligence, and I found that you were right, actually. A Columbia scholar, I'm delighted to report, a Columbia scholar, Nathan Persley, has run polls asking people, do you prefer their living constitution or the original understanding approach? And over a period of 3 years, he found that 54% of the public supports the living constitution approach, and only 44% the originalist approach. What I want to ask you, Justice, is does this matter? There are people marching on the mall, the Tea Party people, waving the Constitution and saying we have to be originalists. Say they persuaded the country and a majority came out the other way and they were originalists. Would you then be an originalist?
No.
Why not? You care about
legitimacy. Because the one thing that isn't relevant when we're deciding a case or deciding what approach to take is whether it's popular in a public opinion poll. The whole point of what we do, after all, is to try to decide the application of the law, often very, very difficult question, in instances where its very purpose in that constitutional document will make it unpopular. I would say, whether it's me or my colleagues, the number of times where a decision would change because an opinion poll showed the opposite was more popular is near zero. If there's one thing the nine of us understand, it's that. I mean, there are other problems, there are other difficulties, but that I really don't think is one. Now, I'll make two other points. One, remember how I say I will answer. They can't remember, they haven't read this, but they might be interested in the answer to a question asked me by a woman who is Chief Justice of Ghana. It's the kind of question I get often. She wants to make her court a better protector of basic rights and democracy a more powerful institution in Ghana. And I get this question often from her and similar people. What's the secret? What's the secret? And my response is normally, I don't know. There is no secret. This document's brief, it's understandable, it's been around for a long time. But the secret, I think I better tell you a little history. And I do it in a much more summary way than I've done in this book. But it's the history that's brought us to a world where we by and large accept decisions. Think of Bush v. Gore. I was in dissent. That was not popular. And for me, it was wrong. And yet I heard Harry Reid say, and I couldn't have agreed with him more, the most remarkable thing about that case is something rarely remarked. What? There were no violent
demonstrations. There was no violence in the street. And the public was willing to carry it out. And when you look at your television and see what goes on in some other places, you can understand why I think, and I know he said he thinks, and I'm sure he does, that that is a treasure for this democracy, which is, after all, 300 million people, every diversity under the sun, living together, and I see it in the courtroom, under law. The court's role, I'm not saying that the court can command obedience, and I am not saying that what it will do will make the difference to that. It's education that will do that. It's learning our history that will do that. But I'm saying the court has a role here too. And the court's role here too, even if it isn't the most powerful psychological factor, is to try to make the law that it enforces, whether statutory or constitutional, something that works better for the public. And then I explain what that means in about 150 pages, so I can't easily summarize it.
Let me ask you about the history, which is the first part of the book, and the stories are riveting. They're familiar cases to those of us who are junkies, but you come up with fresh insights and surprising details. Each of the stories is complicated, but let me just try out one pattern that struck me as I read these four cases. Justice Breyer talks about the story of clashes between four chief justices and four executive officials. Thomas Jefferson versus John Marshall. John Marshall against Andrew Jackson and the Cherokee Indians. Abraham Lincoln against Roger Taney in the Dred Scott case. And finally, Earl Warren against the governor of Arkansas in the Cooper and Aaron case involving the integration of Arkansas schools. What struck me in each of these cases is in the two cases where the president was strongly opposed to the court's ruling, the court backed down or eventually lost. John Marshall ruled for the Cherokees. Andrew Jackson reportedly said, Marshall's made his decision, now let him enforce it. And eventually the troops were sent in on behalf of Georgia, not the Cherokees. Dred Scott was overturned by constitutional amendment. It was the other two cases. Marshall didn't confront Jefferson, Marbury versus Madison, and therefore Jefferson had nothing to react to. And President Eisenhower supported Earl Warren, and therefore the children were escorted with the National Guard to the school where the court came out on top. Does this pattern, if it's true, call into question the court's ability to act unilaterally? And really, can it only succeed when it's acting in conjunction with the president and the Congress and not with their strong opposition?
Acceptance is widespread. And that's why I want people to understand the Cherokee case. I mean, this is 1830s. Gold is discovered on the Cherokee lands. It's in northern Georgia. And the Georgians have this thought. Why should they have it? An understandable thought, perhaps, but a pretty illegal thought. And the court, with John Marshall, says, no, this land belongs to the Cherokees. You're absolutely right. Andrew Jackson said, John Marshall's made his decision, he supposedly said. Now let him enforce it, and sent troops to evict the Cherokees, where they went along the Trail of Tears, and those who survived got to Oklahoma, where their descendants lived to this day. I want to contrast that with what I thought was a great moment. And I want people to know what happened in Little Rock. Little Rock, some of us can remember, where Governor Faubus got up and said, those black children will not come into the white school, and I have the police. I have the militia. Try it. There was a federal court order. Well, you could have had nine judges, 9,000. He had the police. And President Eisenhower was told by Jimmy Burns, who was a great friend of Harry Truman and had been on the Supreme Court and won the mobilization effort, led it in World War II, and then was governor of South Carolina. He said to the president, Mr. President, if you send troops to Little Rock, you will have to reoccupy the South. You will have to have a second reconstruction. And the best thing that's going to happen is that they'll close the schools and nobody will be educated. But Herbert Brownell said, do the opposite. And Eisenhower, which was not an easy decision for him, took the 101st Airborne. Well, again, some of us, at least in this room, can remember who that was. The 101st Airborne was in World War II, those paratroopers who were hung up on the steeples in Normandy and shot down when their parachutes landed them in the wrong place. And they were the heroes of the Battle of the Bulge. And Americans knew that. And that's why Eisenhower chose that division. And he sent 1,000 in airplanes. And they came and they took the black children by the hand, they escorted them into the school. And of course, I think that was a truly great moment for the country and for law in the United States. All right, now you say, I told that story because I like the story. It illustrates a change in attitude towards the court and towards a rule of law, which has grown stronger, not weaker, over time. And I told that story to a Russian paratroop general. See, this paratroop general had previously been in charge of aiming missiles, and they had been aimed at the United States, and he'd been in charge of changing the direction at which those missiles were aimed. And when he came to America, the State Department phoned and said, will you be nice to this gentleman? So he came to the court, and he wanted to know what some of my favorite cases were, and I told him that one. I said, you see, what that shows is that the paratroopers and the judges must be friends.
There was that famous photograph that went around.
Absolutely. The two photographs there that went around the world, which you did not get, you see.
I just have the galley. Which now,
yes, I know. The publishers send you the galley, but if you bought this book, but there are pictures. And the two photographs from that I think are absolutely terrific is one is a woman with her face just enraged as one of those very brave little Rock Nine tried to enter the school and failed. And that picture went around the world. And it was not a happy story being told. And then after, when the 101st Airborne came in, a picture was also taken, and it also went around the world. And it's those pictures, that change, that I think made such a difference to the rule of law. Because it was after that the case went to the Supreme Court. It was after that that the nine judges signed their name all to an opinion which said there will be integration in Little Rock. And the next day, you know what happened. What happened? Sorry, I'm just being professorial. The answer is they closed the schools.
Right.
That's what happened, and nobody was educated for the next year. But the die had been cast. The momentum had changed. And ultimately, with what happened with the 101st, and what happened with the civil rights marches, and what happened with lots and lots and lots of other things, as well as a lot of opinions, ultimately led to a change of a dramatic kind in the legal situation, despite the fact, and some of us can remember, those signs that said impeach Earl Warren. So it's a good story for this reason. Of course, I like it because it has a happy ending.
But you also tell stories that don't have happy endings. You also tell many, yes. You're interested in the fragility of the court, the fact that it can't always convince, that people don't always obey its orders.
Right there in Little Rock, the schools were closed. So that's the kind of thing I would like understood. The schools were closed for a year. Ultimately, they reopened, and integration eventually took place. This segregation legally was dismantled. Still isn't perfect, as we well know, but the change in my lifetime is still enormous, and it could not be brought about simply by nine judges, though they helped. And it's the complexity of that role that I want to try to explain to people so that they see the court does play a role, not always perfectly, but it does play a role, And it's not easy to get busy people who aren't lawyers, who aren't judges, who have to lead lives that are sometimes somewhat difficult, and they don't have time between, if they're married, the children and five other things, which we all understand. But they have to understand enough, I hope, or will, I hope, understand enough to see why this institution, which is there in significant part to protect people where it may be unpopular to do so, is worth support, even if they sometimes get it wrong, even if it's unpopular.
Well, you certainly had me read the Constitution.
Good, so I have one victory right here.
You have one victory right here.
That's good.
It's appealing and convincing when you say the court cannot do it alone. It has, historically, it's acted as a partner of Congress, and it should be pragmatic and pay attention to consequences. Now, I have to say I was surprised, though, by one proposal that you made. You're talking about the Korematsu case, one of the most notorious cases of the 20th century, where the court upholds the internment of the Japanese Americans. And you don't like the solution of Justice Jackson, who said the court should have allowed the executive to act unconstitutionally in the emergency and then struck it down later. You said the court should have been a partner of the executive and allowed the internment, but only under careful regulations the court specified, calibrating the duration of the internment to the procedures given, allowing for review. Were you actually saying that the court should have endorsed the internment?
No, I thought the opposite. I said that I thought the one decision that was right was Murphy. And Murphy said it was wrong to begin with, and it's wrong now. But this is a really fascinating and important story. I can remember that. I was alive during World War II. I can remember the blackout shades in San Francisco. And I can remember my mother taking me in the car. We went to Tan Phran Racetrack, which you drive by on the way down the peninsula, and she said that's where they kept the Japanese in World War II. And the voice of approval, the tone of approval, was not in her voice. If you knew her, you'd understand. And she thought it was terrible. And later, the case came to the Supreme Court. Now, by the time it came to the Supreme Court, the facts were really known. There was a General DeWitt who was in charge of the Sixth Army at the Presidio of San Francisco. And in January of 42, when people were worried about invasion, he said that we have to remove all the Japanese, i.e., by that he included 70,000 American citizens of Japanese origin. And they did remove them. Now, by 1944, the case came to the court. And was that constitutional? By then, when I say people knew what the story was, there were two lawyers in the Justice Department, one named Ennis and the other Berlin. And they were pretty unhappy about what was going on. And they didn't trust what General DeWitt had done. DeWitt had written a report in which he said there are 700 and some odd instances of signaling to Japanese submarines from the shore. It must be a Japanese fifth column. And then he said there are 5 instances of sabotage. These lawyers called the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission. And they said, this is 44. They said, will you look into this? They called the FBI. And they said, will you look into the sabotage? 3 or 4 weeks later, some people from the FCC show up in their office with a pile like this of papers, and they say, there was not one signaling from the shore to the submarines. These were privates who were in the Army for the first time. They'd just gotten in and they got everything mixed up. We've tracked every single one of these. There isn't one. And the lawyers said, but how did you do that so quickly in just 2 or 3 weeks? They said, we did it at the time. And we told General DeWitt. So he knew what we had found. The FBI came back and said, those 5 instances of sabotage, 3 took place after they were already removed, and the 2 others were people we knew. We knew which ones were the spies, and we had them on a list, and they weren't these 70,000 Americans. And J. Edgar Hoover, told this to DeWitt at the time. So the department knew in 1944 what had been going on, and they wrote a footnote in the brief that was pretty obscure, but by the time it got to oral argument in the court, the lawyers for the ACLU made it non-obscure. And they said, read that footnote, and you will see that the Department of Justice has not buying into the theory of the War Department. Well, then the question comes up, well, then why did they uphold it? That's the mystery to me, and I have some answers, but the only one I can think of is they're thinking in their minds. This is Justice Black, Justice Douglas, Frankfurter, the people who later signed on to Brown versus Board. Why did they uphold this? And the only reason that I can think of is they're thinking, well, there's a war on, it might be wrong, but either Franklin Roosevelt runs the war or we do, and we can't. Now, that to me poses a huge, huge problem. The problem is, how does the court react in time of war or national emergency where we have civil liberties on one side and the war power and the need for security on the other? And I put in some things about Guantanamo, because to me it shows a court. I was in the majority in most of those cases. If you'll notice, I tend to favor the cases where I was in the majority and disfavor those. But the point, I think, is it is a court struggling to find a way to protect the civil liberties without undue intrusiveness that would deprive the President of Congress of the power to protect the country where that really is necessary.
Now, Justice,
But I did not think Karamatsu was right. I thought it was wrong.
Forgive me if I misunderstood, but yeah. This is important because it's relevant to Guantanamo, too. At the end of the Korematsu discussion, you say the court might have found a workable way to hold the president constitutionally accountable.
Yeah, I mean,
perhaps it could have developed a sliding scale in respect to the length of detention, the intensity of the examination.
Correct.
It could have insisted the government increase screening efforts.
All right, second edition will make that clear.
No, but
I mean is a sliding scale.
Yes.
We're on the scale, Korematsu would have been off the scale because it would have been illegal to hold the 70,000 Japanese citizens in the camps. I thought that was clear, but in the next edition, if there is one, it will be doubly clear.
But this is important because it does get to the heart of the objection to pragmatism, because what you're suggesting there is what you did in the Guantanamo cases too, the Hamdi case where you joined Justice O'Connor and said, no, it's not like there's no access to habeas corpus at all, but you have to have procedures. We're not going to tell you exactly what they are, but you have to have some access to lawyers, some opportunity to confront. The critics would say, you're enmeshing the court in this unholy system and trying to repair it and in the process blessing it. So what's the response to that?
That is an excellent question. I say there are some people.
The first time.
You did, but I led you off to a deviation. I wasn't trying to dodge it, actually.
History is important.
I wasn't trying to dodge it. It's such an interesting story that when I get started, it's hard for me to stop in the middle of that story. And in response to your question, what I think, which is by no means absolutely clearly right, is the court is faced with a number of choices. On the one hand, you can have some kind of absolutely clear rule that would always apply. And that clear rule would say either you always can detain in such circumstances or you never can. Now, the virtue of such a rule is it is clear. The vice of such a rule is either it will give people too little protection or it will give Congress and the President too little power to protect the country in a circumstance that might really need it. Now, there we are, and you have to choose. And what I'm showing is it will be history. It will be 30 years from now before people know whether or not the court decided correctly in the Guantanamo cases. And I don't necessarily argue those in any depth. I do show how they are trying to track a path which does not abandon protection of civil liberties without which Justice Jackson said, which Justice Goldberg said, whom I worked for, the Constitution is not a suicide pact, and we can't turn it into one. And however unsatisfactory those kinds of results are for people who like clarity of rule, clarity of rule, in my opinion, gets you into, because it's a court and it isn't a law review article, it gets you into, and potentially the country, into serious trouble. And that, of course, is what I find wrong with Jackson's approach. Jackson said, here's what we do. We keep a clear rule. This is absolutely wrong. Don't worry about inhibiting the president and the army, because when the president and the army feel it's necessary to save the country, they will violate the rule. That, they said, he says, is perfect. Because when it's necessary, they violate the rule, and we come along 2 years later and said, you violated it. So they uphold, help the country, and we uphold the Constitution. Well, that is not a foolish position. The things that I find wrong with that position are, you don't quite know how it will work. For one thing, if the president and the Congress really follow the Constitution, it could happen in a war or some other time. Steps will be taken or won't be taken that really were necessary. And the other thing wrong with it, and I think this is in a way a worse one, is they'll get into the habit of violating the law. And if they get into the habit of violating the law, we don't know where we'll be. And if you want to think this is more than a theoretical question, what I'd recommend to people is Israel has been right in the middle of this question. And their Supreme Court has had again and again to face this kind of question. And if I put it in very general terms, I would say you try more to just have a principle that's absolutely clear, but expect people to violate it, or do you try to get the law and what has to be done and the protection of the civil liberty to work out? And I think what you're seeing, it's just my opinion, and it's a commentary on it, I think you're seeing in the Guantanamo cases, every one of which the prisoner won, I think you're seeing an effort by the court to protect the civil liberties without going unnecessarily far.
I thought of one other objection when I read the account of the Guantanamo cases, which, as you suggest, are a remarkable achievement. The fact that the court was able in these four cases to rule for the defendant and to be accepted is a sign of its power. But it did not seem terribly practical in working with Congress in the way that you endorse. In the Hamdi case, you allowed the detention of the citizens as enemy combatants, despite the fact that Congress had not explicitly authorized it. Then Congress did authorize it at the president's request, and you, in the Boumediene case, said that Congress can't suspend habeas corpus, so that was no good either. How is that consistent with the effort to work constructively and deferentially with Congress, which you endorse so persuasively in the rest of the book?
I have two, not responses, but two comments on what you say. And the first is that when one of the least popular people in the United States, Bin Laden's driver, can sue one of the most powerful people in the country, the President of the United States, and when he can win his case, which says that under the law he was not being given a proper kind of hearing, that is not a victory for the court. That is a victory for the country. And it reflects a very long history. My second comment is that trying to work with Congress does not mean giving them a blank check. That what we're trying to do in the court is we are taking this document. This document is what I call a series of outlines. It is a document that tries to create in the first seven articles a system of institutions that will basically function democratically. At the same time, it tries to protect, particularly in the first 10 amendments, fundamental rights of individuals. It tries to divide power vertically between the states and the federal government, horizontally among three branches, so that no single group of people in the government become too powerful. It insists upon a degree of equality, and it assures a rule of law. Now, when I've given that rough outline, I think all nine of us would say, yes, that essence is there. But you see, it's an outline, they're general terms, and it is sketching guidelines. It is the boundaries. What people do in the United States is to vote as to what kinds of communities, what kinds of states, what kinds of nation they want. What this does is set the boundaries. So I think of our job as we are at the frontier. What we are saying is, does Congress go inside or outside the boundary? And there's nothing, and I hope what I've said, or what any of the others of us said, that Congress has a blank check to decide itself. That's the opposite of what Hamilton decided to do. So we're the boundary patrol. Is life at the boundary easy? I've said this 1,000 times. I used to listen to Sky King of the Mounties. He was up in Canada on the frontier, and it was very cold and unpleasant and difficult. Is abortion inside or outside the boundary? Is prayer in schools inside or outside the boundary? What exactly is the boundary sketched by this word liberty in the 14th Amendment? What, in fact, is the boundary of the freedom of speech, which does not define itself? Of course those questions are difficult. And of course people could come to different answers on the same question. But however difficult they are, the space that is not difficult in between is broad. And it is that space where the democratic system operates.
I found a little quotation by Stuart Hampshire that might get to this point. He says, the value of a democratic constitution lies in the defense of minorities, not majorities.
I think that's a reiteration, whether he knew it or not, of what Hamilton thought. Hamilton thinks if all we're doing is deciding what the popular thing to do is, let's have Congress do it. They're experts. If, however, some of the time at least, we're going to have to say no to what's popular in order to keep the document alive, well, then you better not have Congress do it. And those cases will be tested. Tested when a minority is at issue. The least popular person in the United States. I don't know exactly who that is. I hope it's nobody I know. But the least popular person in the United States has the same rights if he's accused of a crime as everybody else, okay? I mean, that's just basic, just fundamental.
Now, Justice, as you note in the book, this is a divided court. And you note that just about a couple terms ago, 2007 or something, there were a series of cases involving campaign finance and abortion and affirmative action and antitrust, and they were 5-4 decisions, and you were in the dissent in all of them. Now, when the Chief Justice came into office, he said that he wanted narrow, unanimous opinions, and he said this would increase the legitimacy of the court. Why hasn't he gotten them, and is he likely to be more successful in getting them in the future?
Well, he could have agreed with me. It would have helped make it. People don't always agree. There we are. And I used to think, look, I was born in San Francisco. I lived most of my life in Massachusetts. I thought I'd met people with a lot of different opinions. Ha, ha, ha. I mean, I've met people who have really different opinions. And when I think about that, of course it's irritating at some level that someone doesn't agree with you. We all have that experience. But this is a very big country. There are 300 million people. I mean, as you well know, they think many, many different things. And it is not such a terrible thing that there are people on my own court who fundamentally disagree with some of the things I think. Don't forget, however, that we have quite a large number of cases and probably were unanimous dangerous 30 to 40% of the time. And we're probably 5-4, maybe 20 or 25% of the time. And it is not always the same 5 and the same 4. So let us not lose sight of this forest. And that's all right.
So inquiring minds want to know what is going to happen. And you don't know, and I don't know, but what does history teach us about what might happen if this court were to challenge the President and Congress on matters they care intensely about? Who will win, the Congress or the court?
My job is a job to decide individual cases as they come up. And I try to devote my time and effort to that, to getting them right. It is the job of other people, you and historians and others, to predict outcomes and consequences. And that isn't being coy. It's because I don't know. I probably know less well than you. I mean, there are people who've written histories of the court, and I'll just stop because I don't think I can, nor should I properly, try to figure out what the consequences of that will be.
But the whole book is about how the court should behave to maintain legitimacy. So without talking about any particular cases or even anything specific, how should the court avoid a self-inflicted wound, as you described several times in this book, that might imperil its legitimacy now and in the future?
This part of the book that you're talking about is the following. I think, and this is my primary target, if you like, it's that people think, oh, it's all politics. And I want to say enough from my point of view that people will think, if I start thinking it's all politics, I'm grossly exaggerating the situation. It's not the right word. It's just not the right word. And I try to say enough to become fairly convincing on that, because I believe it. And then people, if they think it isn't all politics, think, oh, it's 9 people up there just doing whatever they want to do. Look, we have criteria for taking cases. We take cases almost always when lower court judges have come to different conclusions on the same question of federal law, statute or constitution. And while these criteria don't determine it, they make fairly clear what we'll take and what we won't take. And I don't sit there thinking how nice it would be to hear a case like this or hear one like that. So, and as far as doing what I like, I feel I never do what I like. Ask my Joanna, she'll say I've had that self-pitying attitude for years. But the fact is, no, it's not doing what I like. But you see, the view of originalism, which is do this on the basis of history, has to be said for it, that it represents an effort by people to stop judges from using their subjective view of what's good or bad instead of the law. And so those who favor it say, look back to history in depth and in detail, and that will control the judge. And what I'm trying here is to say, no, I feel that won't work. That's not going to work. It's too hard to know what's in history on most of the really open questions in detail. You can know the values, you can know free speech is about expression, you know in general what it's about, but you don't know the details. And appoint 9 historians instead of 9 judges if you want to do everything on the basis of history. And I go into that in some depth. All right, so I say, well, what's the alternative here? And I say, an approach that is the alternative, and that's an alternative, and that's what I'm trying to explain, is American and old. Read Gordon Wood, who's a great historian. He talks about the judges here in the United States in 1780, 1790. I love the quote he had, which was from a judge from Connecticut. So Jesse Root, I think. He said, the American tradition of law, of appellate law, of working out how law applies to difficult cases and what it means, he said, that's one of prudence and pragmatism. And the judges I admire, most people do, learned hand, Brandeis, Cardoza, Holmes. My goodness, they seem to me to exemplify that kind of attitude. So if I simply say something like, Well, it's an attitude that takes the values that were written into the Constitution 200 years ago and applies them to today's changing circumstances. If I stop there, you're going to think that's a nice sentiment. Say it on the 4th of July. So what I've tried to do is to put some meat on those bones and to try to say what something like that can mean to at least one judge in a number of different areas of law. Now, I don't say it's the only way, but I do say it's one way.
You take up Justice Brandeis's challenge. I want to ask him this because I'm very curious about the answer. And you insist on translating the Constitution in light of new technologies, and this is a necessary and exciting project. What do we do, and again, I'm not asking for a judgment, just an approach, about the fact that today, the people who have more control over free speech and privacy and civil liberties than any Supreme Court justice or any government or any king are the lawyers at Google and Facebook. They're the ones who decide who shall speak, who can demonstrate, who can take down their pictures, their drunken pictures that define them forever, but they're not regulated by the First Amendment or the Fourth Amendment. How do we translate those constitutional values, as you put it, into an age where it's the private sector and not government that may menace them?
Article of faith. Shall I give you an article of faith?
Please.
All right, article of faith. It starts with Tocqueville. He says in 1835 or so forth, you know what he hears when he comes to the United States? He calls it the clamor. What's that? It's everybody screaming at each other. Now, that isn't very polite, but it does mean that they're in a discussion, sometimes stronger, sometimes less strong. Privacy. What's happened to privacy with the new technologies? How do we deal with it? Well, you'll write an article about it, and so will 5,000 others.
Exactly.
You wrote a book about it, and so will 5,000 others. And we'll discuss this in classrooms. We'll discuss it at meetings. They'll discuss it in police departments. They'll discuss it at ACLU meetings. They will have hearings in states, in cities, in the Congress. There will be administrators who will try rules. We'll try it. It won't work. We'll change it. And everything will be open to criticism. And gradually, maybe something will emerge.
We're discussing it right here.
Right. Well, look, if something emerges, and the last step is to see whether that which emerges is consistent with those guidelines in this document. And our court works best when all those other steps have been taken. That's called the screaming democratic process in action. It sometimes works, I think, quite a lot. That's my article.
I think some of the ways in which you relish maybe disagreement comes from your appreciation of literature. This is my article of faith. And I want to read this to you and see how you react. In 1856, in an essay she wrote on German realism, George Eliot had this to say: "The greatest benefit we owe to the artist, whether painter, poet, or novelist, is the extension of our sympathies. Art is the nearest thing to life. It is a mode of amplifying experience and extending our contact with our fellow men beyond the bounds of our personal lot."
I wish I'd had that. I was talking at New York Law School, and for some reason we got off on this subject, and one of the students said, "What should I major in if I want to be a lawyer?" So, being a little difficult, I said, "Anything has nothing to do with law." I said, "This is a good chance for you." And then someone said, "Well, I mean, even literature?" I said, "Why not?" And I didn't say that. That's what she says. I mean, look, we have one life. This is how I put it to the student. I said, "We have one life, one. We know our own. And maybe we know a little bit, a few others. But if you read some books, you can be exposed to a lot of people's lives. And that's doubly true if you know a foreign language. And so it's fabulous. Learn a foreign language. and read a few books about other people, and that will, in fact, help you, because it'll give you many lives. And indeed, if you're going to be a judge, and you're going to be locked up in an appeals court, what you do every day is sit and read some briefs, and turn around and look at the word processor, you better have had some experience beforehand, and you better be able to imaginatively understand the lives of other people, because what you write is going to affect those lives. So I wish I'd had your quotation.
Well, I'll give you the quotation, but how... tell me this, how does the reading of literature help? How does it help? How would you say that the way in which it helps is because it gives you the ability to put yourself in somebody else's shoes?
It helps that way?
Through empathy? What is the role of empathy for a judge?
I wouldn't go beyond what I said. It's very helpful to be able to understand how your opinions will affect people who have a lot of different lives than you. When you hear that raft with Huck Finn and Jim, I mean, my God, there is sympathy at a period where it was hard to have at that time. And you suddenly see this tremendous, tremendous warm emotion between people. And you in a very different style of life, and a very tough one for Jim. And you find that in Uncle Tom's Cabin. I mean, remember Lincoln said when he met Harriet Beecher Stowe, he said, "Oh, you're the little lady who started this great war." Well, there was something to that. Because when you read that, it's a good novel, in my opinion. It is not a tract. And what she is doing is trying to show you how slavery cannot work. And she does that by showing you the people involved. And once you see the people involved, and what's involved in separating families, people who were previously indifferent or said, "It isn't my problem," would suddenly say, "My goodness, maybe it is my problem." So those are the kinds of things that books can do, and why we read and why we try to understand other people. That's what I was trying to explain to the students.
And what is the importance? It's pretty obvious in some ways, but if you had to say, what is the importance of actually learning a foreign language? What does that grant you more than reading in what
it
might...
It does, I think.
In what way?
I was asked this question, I think, well, years ago when I was a student, and I see my friend Paul Dodik is here, and we were traveling around in Europe in this beat-up old car. And we stayed with a woman called Maria Comberti, who lived behind an alley somewhere in Florence, and one of our student days. And she said to me at one point, she said, "Well, with every language you learn, if you learn..." She spoke about sex or something. But she said, you become another person. You learn another... You can be somebody different. You learn insight into something. And I don't care if it's French or Spanish or Chinese or whatever, but it's a window. It's a window into a civilization that is different, and yet there are people who are similar. And I can't go beyond that. But I think it's a very, very valuable thing for anyone to know a language that isn't just theirs. And that's a similarity I see with literature. I'm not an expert on these subjects.
Paul is going to get you into trouble for reaffirming President Obama's empathy standard, which is good. You were sharing with Paul some of your favorite books, and one jumped out. There are many exciting ones on the list. Adams, The Education of Henry Adams. So Adams is struggling with this idea that his 18th century education failed to prepare him for life in 20th century America in light of the changes of technologies. He's wandering between two worlds, one dead, the other powerless to be born. But he's moderately optimistic. Are you moderately optimistic that
I like this book. The reason these came up is because Joe Weiler, who is a professor at NYU Law School, and I have a friend named Norman Dorson. And Norman Dorson is reaching a certain birthday, which I will not tell you what it is. But anyway, Weiler had the idea that 10 of his friends should write down 10 books which influence their professional career. Not books they think are great literature, because don't, you know. So we did, and write a few words on each. So he unfortunately finds this list, and that's why he's asking me these questions. Because five things on the list.
Nothing to be ashamed of.
No, I'm not ashamed of it.
They're great books.
Yes, I agree, they're great
books.
And
even though you may not be a specialist of it, people want to know what has touched you.
All right, so five of these were pretty legal. So we'll stay away from those. Now, he's gotten to one that isn't totally legal, which is The Education of Henry Adams, which I put down because I found it absolutely terrific. Why? Because a person is living across the 19th century, or quite a lot of it. He's born into a world where people thought there would be some kind of elite that would, in fact, guide us, though elected. But we'd sort of know who were the right people here. And he is told that the real elite lives in the South. So he goes down there and looks. He says, these are people, a bunch of ruffians. He says, I'm not saying they are. I'm just saying that's what Henry Adams said, because he's so much against slavery. And then he goes and lives in Washington for a while and becomes, in essence, a pundit. And the best political observer I can remember reading. And he looks at what's going on. Some of you remember the NAST cartoons, seeing them when we were in high school, about it's big tobacco here, and there's bribery over there, and there's this other thing over. He says, this is terrible. There is no reason to favor democracy. It just isn't working. And then he says, but what's the choice? What's the choice? Before Churchill, he said that. And you read across how he is both worried, but ultimately has faith in the process. And that goes across a period of time, which, I mean, I heard Ken Galbraith say this years ago. He said, we get upset about various things that are happening. There was real bribery. And it wasn't very subtle either. And there were a lot of things wrong with democracy. And there always have been. It hasn't worked perfectly. But Adams eventually brings us around to the point where we understand the reasons for his faith. And I like that. That's why I put that in.
Among the books you have enjoyed, one of them is of monumental importance, is La Recherche du Temps Perdu, Marcel Proust. And I have a question here that comes to you all the way from California. An old tutor of yours, who's an old friend of mine, who you studied with in 1959, a man named Herbert Morris.
I saw him the other day.
I know. He sends you regards. And... I knew him when I was out in Los Angeles and reading an article. I think it might have been Jeff's article where you mentioned Herbert Morris, or Jeffrey Toobin mentioned Herbert Morris. And I wrote to Herbert Morris and I said, is this the same Herbert Morris I know who taught Justice Bryant? He said, yes, and remember me kindly to him. And I said, no, do better than that. You love literature. I think Justice Bryant does too. Ask him a question that I can ask from the stage. And he has this question to ask you about Proust. What does he think, Justice Breyer, about Marcel Proust's observation in The Search of Lost Time when he writes with regard to Mademoiselle de Vinteuil, one of his sadistic artists in evil, that perhaps she would not have thought of evil as a state so rare, so abnormal, so exotic, one in which it was so refreshing to sojourn, had she been able to discern in herself, as in everyone else, that indifference to the suffering one causes, which whatever other name one gives it, is the most terrible and lasting the most lasting form of cruelty.
Well, all I can say is it's a good thing he didn't give me a final examination. I mean, I remember, I think maybe he's talking about Madame Verdurin. Vinteuil was the one who was a composer.
That's right.
And all right, I'm stumped. It sounds to me as if it's right, but it was a long quotation. I think the theme of this is what we've been talking about. I think the theme of it is to understand what effect you have on other people. And it's very hard for someone to be determinedly wrong when they know that they're hurting some other person. It's lack of imagination that is really the problem so much more often. I'll give you another example. And tell me if this is one. One of the things I really liked in Tocqueville, he says he's talking about a very well-known French writer in the 17th century, a woman, Madame de Sévigné, who wrote some letters. And she was the kindest woman you could have thought of. She adored her daughter. And she wrote to her daughter, who was far on the other side of France, every day. in the most beautiful form, but she really did adore her daughter. And in one of her letters, which Tocqueville quotes, she says, "Well, nothing much is happening here, but this morning we had a slight disruption. Some of the peasants from nearby came into the garden and were trying to steal some fruit, but we hanged them. And so nothing much has happened this afternoon." And then she goes on. And he says, how could this woman, who is such really a sympathetic person, say such a thing and pass it off in this way? And he says, the answer is, she's not seeing these other people as people, at least not people like us. And it's the breakdown of that barrier of they are people like us that Tocqueville finds is happening. And at his time, it hadn't happened completely in the United States, but comparatively speaking, it had. And that's what he sees as a strength of the American Republic, which is the direction he thinks that Europe will go into. So that's what that suggests.
Can and should judges show that empathy?
Judges, as I've said, the way I put it is the words that I use, which I think is that you have to be able, imaginatively, my wife is English and that's the word she uses, which means you have to try to understand the impact that your decision will actually have upon other people. That's part of the law. That isn't something separate from law. The laws that are enacted by Congress and the Constitution are meant to allow people to live together in this community, whichever the community is that the law governs. That's basic. That's basic.
You're particularly interested also in the idea of rereading, how certain books that affected us in early years might still affect us now, how our taste may evolve through aging. And I think one of the books that comes to mind to you often is a book by Albert Camus, The Plague. And you said to me that you found The Plague in some way quite close to the very work you do as a judge. And the last pages of The Plague speak to you in a particularly strong way. Why is that so?
Well, I read it in college, and I reread it not too long ago. And suddenly it did speak to me for this reason. It's really a story of ostensibly takes place in Oran in Algeria, and it's infested with a plague, and they have to close it off. And it's really about the Nazi occupation of France. And some people act very well, and some act very badly, and you have all kinds of range of human nature there. And he goes through this, and you see what I think he's thinking of the occupation, which was pretty awful for the French. And he ends up by saying, why did I write this book? What he means is not him. He puts these words in his main character, Rieu, who's a doctor. He says, one reason I did, I wanted people to know the story of these people, their bravery and their cowardice, everything. And he says, the second reason is that I'm a doctor. And I think a doctor is a pretty good model for how you should behave in the world. Not necessarily thinking through all these complicated things, but acting in ways that help others. But he says the third reason, which may be most important, he says the bacillus de la peste, it's the germ of the plague. He said it never dies and it doesn't disappear. He says it goes into remission and it lurks there. It lurks in the hallways, or it lurks in the cupboards. It lurks in the clothes, and it lurks in the file cabinets, only perhaps to reawaken one day, and then misfortune, or perhaps the education of mankind, it will once again send forth its rats to die in a happy city. Well, I think, well, why do we have our institutions? Why is the court there? It's there in part as a kind of dike, but it's a weak dike, but it's still an effort. It's an effort to guard against that day when those rats might come forth. Look around the world. You can see that bacillus or whatever, it's there. And so more and more institutions throughout the world have tried here. And one of the reasons for having an independent judiciary is a small dike that maybe a little bit of a help should those rats reemerge. Anyway, that's what rereading that book told me, and that's why I liked it.
Jeff, did you have a question before I have a final question for Justice Breyer?
Justice, we've been talking about these issues for years. You're an optimistic, tempered person. You had a positive, sunny view of government that emerged from working at working in San Francisco, working in Congress on all sorts of reforms. You've been at the center of one of the most polarized courts during the most polarized time in government, and there are many who are not optimistic about the fate of our democracy. How optimistic are you, and why, about the future?
I don't have a privileged version here. I mean, but think of the Churchill comment. There are lots of them. They say the same thing. What's the basis for Adams' optimism? What's the basis for Churchill's optimism? Churchill said that the United States always does the right thing after having exhausted every other possible alternative. Well, there's something to that.
Upon entering this venerable institution here, you told me that you had a couple of poems.
You told me to bring a couple of poems.
I did. Yes. So, and you also told me that these are poems that matter to you greatly. I would like you to read them.
I'll read one, and because what I think is
I'll read one
what matters to me is what I happen to be reading recently, and it could be anything. It could be anything. So I think it's getting late, so I think we have time for one. I was going to read two, but I want to show you this one, and I'll tell you why. It's an okay poem. It's a good poem. It's by Billy Collins, whom I like. And I heard him say this poem, and suddenly it stuck in my mind. It's called The Lanyard. Would you like to hear it?
I love it.
Yes, yeah. Okay. The other day, I was ricocheting slowly off the blue walls of this room, moving as if underwater from typewriter to piano, from bookshelf to an envelope lying on the floor, when I found myself in the L section of the dictionary where my eyes fell upon the word lanyard. No cookie nibbled by a French novelist could send one into the past more suddenly, a past where I sat at a workbench at a camp by a deep Adirondack lake, learning how to braid long, thin plastic strips into a lanyard. A gift for my mother. I had never seen anyone use a lanyard or wear one, if that's what you did with them, but that did not keep me from crossing strand over strand again and again until I had made a boxy red and white lanyard for my mother. She gave me life and milk from her breasts, and I gave her a lanyard. She nursed me in many a sick room, lifted spoons of medicine to my lips, laid cold face cloths on my forehead, and then led me out into the airy light and taught me to walk and swim, and I in turn presented her with a lanyard. Here are thousands of meals, she said, and here is clothing and a good education, and here is your lanyard, I replied, which I made with a little help from a counselor. Here is a breathing body and a beating heart, strong legs, bones and teeth, and two clear eyes to read the world, she whispered, and here, I said, is the lanyard I made at camp. And here I wish to say to her now is a smaller gift, not the worn truth that you can never repay your mother, but the rueful admission that when she may, where did it go? Where is the end of this poem? Pat Haas, did I give it to you on that piece of paper? I gave you two pieces of paper. Well, you will never know the end of this poem. But I can tell you why I selected that poem. And the reason is because my granddaughter, Clara, who is 7, made me this lanyard.
Thank you very much. Justice Breyer, thank you very much.